is tape three, the morning of September 14th. Mr. President, you were just saying some very important thing about the legislative...
The Constitution of the United States was so drawn that it would fit the situation with a few amendments whenever it came up, no matter how it came up, and the legislative branch of the government was left to make the laws. A great many of these state constitutions are not constitutions, they are legislative documents drawn with legislation in the Constitution, which makes it almost impossible for a constitution to work. There isn't a state in the Union, I don't think, that hasn't had to rewrite its constitution time and again, and every time they rewrite it, it has more legislation in it. And a great many of the state constitutions are absolutely unworkable for that reason. The Constitution of the United States is not a legislative document. It provides for legislation by the body that's authorized and is capable of legislating. And that's the way it ought to be.
It is an amazing theory. I never heard this before. Now, would it be then, in your sense, more of an executive guide than a legislative guide?
It's both. It's both. It's a guide for the legislature. It's a basis on which the legislative branch of the government can operate and legislate for things as they come along. Times change. Different things come up. Previous to 1860, we had a slave situation in the country. After 1860, with all the great development in the Far West, we had the old pirates who tried to control the finances and the transportation of the country. They had to meet that with the Interstate Commerce Commission and several other things that have come about as a result of that, all under the Constitution of the United States. Well, now, so a great many states limit the term of their governors. And no governor can put over a program in the session of two legislatures. It just isn't possible to be done. And yet, Missouri has had three constitutions since it was organized. And every single one of them contains legislation that ought not to be in a constitution. When they put these constitutions out as legislative documents, it means that they don't trust their legislative bodies. And that's the difficulty with most of them. And the Constitution of the United States is not that way, although there have been 3,000 or 4,000 amendments proposed to the Constitution of the United States that would make it a legislative document and absolutely ruin its purpose.
There have been as many as those, Mr. President.
Yes, there's been between 3,000 and 4,000 amendments offered to the Constitution. They only passed 22, and they only passed two bad ones in passing those 22,
and
in my opinion.
And in what way, and in what way were these legislative amendments? In what way were they?
Well, the latest one is the Bricker Amendment, which would limit the taxing power of the United States government to 25% of a man's income.
In other words,
absolutely close up the government.
In other words, to take away from Congress the
Congress
right,
right to do the legislating on a representative basis of all the people.
That's a good example of what you mean by legislation in the Constitution.
Yes,
the Bricker Amendment is not the taxation amendment, is it?
Yes, that's the taxation
amendment. I thought it was the other.
There's another Bricker Amendment which limits the power of Congress to legislate, which is just as bad as the Bricker Amendment they asked to do with the levying of taxes.
Yes.
Both
and
of them are
treaties
bad.
Also, foreign policy, wasn't there a Bricker Amendment on foreign policy?
Yes,
yes. Well, that,
that's
that,
the one
that,
I'm talking about.
Yes, yes. That would not permit any treaties that were made to be the law of the land as it is today.
That's what they want to do.
Well, then, your interpretation of the Constitution is that it's a guide and a philosophy, but not a specific directive.
It's not hard and fast or cast iron. The Constitution is a document under which the Congress of the United States and the President can legislate for the welfare and benefit of the people in the time and with the necessary legislation that's needed at that time.
And then the whole interpretation of the Constitution and application then depends upon the ability of the legislative and the ability of the executive.
That's correct.
To make it work.
That's
and
correct.
Also depends upon the circumstances and time.
That's correct.
It's adaptable to circumstances.
Yes,
it's what it has been. It's what it has been. There haven't been any revolutions in this country except an effort in the Civil War to split the country up, and it didn't work. And they're all back and all happy. Although sometimes this is a secede in a political campaign, but that's customary.
Had a very profitable morning.
All right, this is the end of take three. Mr. President, this is the morning of September the 16th, and this is the first take. Now, you had a question, did you, Dave?
First question this morning was the influence of time, or the effect of time, on the interpretation of events, so that we could get some idea of Why, history is always undergoing changes with time and readjustments and evaluation.
That's true. That's true. And the Constitution, we're lucky to say, was so arranged that it could meet the changes in conditions as time went on. As I said yesterday, experience has taught us that that Constitution will fit the situation no matter what it is as it arises if the leadership is capable of putting it into effect. And that's what's taking place all the way down through the various crises that this government has been. There has always been the appearance of a leader who has succeeded in constitutionally doing what had to be done.
Well, how do you achieve a fair and accurate assessment of history? Well, what is the process?
Well, my approach to it has always been to read of the event and then find out what caused the event, and there's always a man or men mixed up in any event that's taken place historically. And then, if you know the background and the history of the men, you can come to a conclusion as to why that situation took place.
Yes, but what Dave asked for was whether there's always a fair and accurate estimate of history.
No, there isn't. There isn't a fair and accurate estimate of history, and that's the reason you have to study all sides of it. The best example of what can happen in the historical documents happens every day when in the court procedure. You can take a man, will sue another one for an accident or a car collision, and he'll have his set of witnesses, and the other man will have his set of witnesses, and every one of them are eyewitnesses to the accident, and every one of them will have a different approach to what happened at that accident. That happens in history, just the same.
Well, that's correct. But how do the historians, as a group, evolve into a class of individuals who assess history with authority as against any other prevailing opinions? Let's say that these people who take it upon themselves to do what we would call in modern times a psychoanalytical study of the men of importance during a certain period. Well, how do you become a historian in that sense, as you see it?
Well, these men who are looked up to as authorities in history are men who study all sides of this question. As I could continue the analogy, they know both sides of the case. And then they evaluate the result of what happened and come to their own conclusions. And if they're fair-minded men, their conclusions are usually as nearly correct as they can become.
But you're getting into an area of very, very highly distilled judgment. Judgment in terms of deeds and achievements and misjudgments, and, which calls for a highly skilled and a curiously equipped mind to handle this kind.
They're very hard to find. It's very difficult to find them. You take as an illustration, the Civil War, the American Civil War, or the British Civil War, the War of the Roses. Every side of that was told in a different way by the combatants on each side. And then the historians eventually evaluated the result of what happened and wrote what they thought was the proper approach to the historical events that took place. Now, you've got to accept the judgment of these historians, because that's the only way you can arrive at a conclusion. If they're a reliable man and not prejudiced, you can always tell when a fellow's writing a tale from one point of view for his own aggrandizement or to justify something that he himself has done historically in the period.
Well, Mr. President, don't you think there that a lot of so-called historians have arrogated a lot of authority to themselves, which time sweeps away? Because after all, a historian is just a man who attempts to write about certain events and about certain documents. He comes to it with certain prejudices. Don't you think we emphasize too much what historians think? Because,
well, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. But you must take into consideration that that has to be done. Now, you take the reason I have been so strong for the opening of the papers of the presidents to be compared with the records which have been made by the legislative body and by the judicial branch of the government is that when all the facts are brought to light from the actual documents on which the president works, and compared with the documents and the records of the courts in the in our own country, or the courts in the legislative branch of the government, we then come out with what actually took place, and then we can compare what the historians had to say about it, and you'll find there are a great many inaccuracies, even in school books on history. On the history of the United States, and that's only a short period when you compare it with the history of the world.
Don't you think about the purest type of historians at the beginning of the of this nation were really men like Madison and Hamilton, who in the Federalist Papers attempted to report what they had tried to do in the Constitutional Convention. They were really the best type of historians.
No doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. And then the debates that took place on the adoption of the Constitution all over the United States, all over the colonies. For instance, Patrick Henry was one of the bitterest opponents of the Constitution of the United States. They asked me one time to go down and dedicate a monument to him. I said I wouldn't do it because it wouldn't be any United States if old Pat Henry had his way.
Well, now, is history, just to refine it a little further, is history a collection of recollections and documents and facts, just so that it can be filed away and with a little tag in memoriam, or is history a live and vigorous and pulsating thing designed to aid and assist in the guidance of men who succeed to leadership?
Someone has said the only way you can anticipate the future is to judge what may happen by what has happened in the past. And if you're not familiar with the situation in the past as it affects whatever you're trying to do, you will have a very, very difficult time in judging on a decision that you may have to make that will affect the whole future.
Well, now, in terms of your personal experience, you set up the committee during the Second World War, which you headed up, known as the Truman Committee, or the Committee on the Conduct. What was it exactly? Conduct
Committee to investigate the National Defense Program.
National Defense Program. And you limited the scope and interest of that committee to those things that had no bearing upon the actual conduct of the war itself.
That's correct. Because
why did you do that?
Well, the conduct of the war was in the hands of the President of the United States. He was Commander-in-Chief. Just the same as he makes the foreign policy of the United States, he's in absolute command of the military forces when they're in a war. And Lincoln was terribly embarrassed and caused a great deal of trouble by that committee, joint committee known as the Committee on the Conduct of the War. They had old Ben Wade and old man Gooch and Chandler from Michigan and several others. And I was bound and determined, having read the records of that committee, not to allow this committee on the investigation of the defense program to get in any way interfere with the military program of the Commander-in-Chief. That was the reason for it. And the objective of that committee was to see that the federal government was obtaining for the funds expended value received. And it's estimated that a great deal of money was saved by the investigation of that committee. Now, after the First World War and after the other wars, immense numbers of investigating committees went into things that happened in the conduct of the war behind the lines, which, had they been investigated at the time, could have been corrected at that time. I think there were 116 investigating committees after the First World War, and all that investigation was a waste of time because the thing had happened in the past and there was nothing they could do. There were no investigations of any consequence after the Second World War because that committee of which I was the head prevented it.
Well, now, you were trying to prevent scandals and prevent miscarriages of
that's correct. That's absolutely correct.
Action.
Because unless the supply service behind the lines, the construction of the camps and things of that sort, and the manufacture of tanks and guns and things of that kind, was properly carried on, the Commander-in-Chief won't have the tools with which to win a war.
Well, you just weren't out to save money then, were you?
Oh, no, it was to help win the war, and it made a greater contribution. I'm kind of egotistical when I say that, as the man who commanded the division on the front.
Well, Mr. President, as time goes on, the records of governments, of current governments, increase in size and bulk because of printing and other modern facilities. Isn't it going to be more difficult to write history if you're going to weigh all the material?
Oh, yes. It's going to be an almost impossible job. It's going to take a core of helpers for any historian to get at the facts of the modern setup.
In other words, what is important then is an approach by the historian who doesn't pretend to exhaust all possibilities, but to have a point of view. In other words, a historian ought to have a point of view.
That's true. He's got to have a point of view, and he usually expresses it, sometimes subtly and sometimes not.
Well, then, what is your feeling in doing this thing? You're expressing your point of view based on?
On the facts as I can assemble them, and the facts that we can obtain, and on which we may base our belief as to why this happened or why that happened. And it'll be stated categorically that that is the case. And if somebody else wants to make further investigation and come to another conclusion, that's his privilege.
In other words, a conclusion will be always based on the personality of the man who's investigating.
Well, to a great extent. But he's got to be objective. He has to have an objective viewpoint. And to try as best he can to set the facts in the line so that they'll justify his conclusion. And he mustn't leave out any facts because somebody might take facts because come to a different conclusion.
But yet the point of view of the author does influence his conclusions?
There's no question about that. It has to.
And in that sense, history is not written, but rewritten by the succeeding group of historians who try to interpret the interpreters again.
That's always the case. They've begun that already. And it happens to be that I'm alive and I can head off some of the interpretations that they want to make. And that's what we have been doing right along.
Now, do historians, as Bill just said, they try to be objective, but actually they editorialize, don't they?
Oh, naturally. Of course they do. Just like a newspaper. Some chains of papers in this country editorialize their news, and some that do not. That's the difference between them.
Well, isn't it important for a historian to have a point of view?
He must have a point of view.
Or a prejudice, because then he may shed a different light from that which is shed by another historian.
That's correct. I have no objection to that, but then you want to be careful if you're making a study of history to be sure that you get all sides before you make up your own mind.
What are the sources that enable a historian to get all points of view? Because there you run into the problem of the recording of events as they take place. Now, how do you get at those?
Well, the approach, I think, in modern times has been to where a record has been left by the man who is responsible for making the events take place, has left a record of his own, then you have now a tremendously well-covered news service in the country in the form of newspapers, magazines, and television and radio broadcasts and things of that kind that can be referred to if a man is trying to settle a controversy that took place in somebody's administration, and that's what we're going to try to do as we go through with this thing. He then has access to all these documents, but it's a tremendous research job. That's the reason he has to have so much help to get the thing done right.
Now let me get to a very blunt question on this whole business. How can a mere instructor or even a full professor in history sit down and contemplate the acts of anyone present without having personally a sense of it?
He can't. But most of them do.
We want to get the, this is right here.
All right, Mr. President, this is the end of tape one on the morning of September the 16th.